you're in disadvantage already because you're a guest worker and you don't want to be judged for not looking a certain way. So there was a lot of attention paid to getting festive and dressing up. So that's really the obsession we have with those different types of garments and clothing.
Das ist der Telekom Electronic Beats Podcast, der Podcast rund um Nachtleben und Clubkultur.
Wir sprechen mit DJs, Türstehern, Tänzern, Clubbetreibern und anderen Nachtmenschen.
Mein Name ist Gesine Kühne.
Und ich bin Jakob Töne.
Herzlich willkommen beim Electronic Beats Podcast.
Hi, it's me, Jakob Töne, and welcome to the Telekom Electronic Beats podcast. Today's episode is going to be in English again, as I met two English-speaking men from Berlin who created and founded a fashion brand that not only entered the international fashion scene with huge success, but it's also the only German brand showcased at the current official Fashion Week in Paris. I talked to Benjamin Alexander Hüsebi and Serhat Ischik of GmbH. They are pretty much rooted in the nightlife scene in Berlin, so we talked about how they experienced a danceless time during Corona and how they managed to survive as a company during this uncertain time. Benjamin and Serhat also told me about their approach to design their fashion, fashion as a medium of their messages, and a coincidence at the factory in Italy that somehow led to the title of Berlin's clubbing uniform. But I don't want to get too much away, let's start with a conversation with GmbH's Benjamin and Serhat. Hi, Benjamin. Hi, Serhat. Welcome to the podcast. I really like quotes, and I wanted to start off with one. I don't know who said that exactly, but maybe you can tell me. We all have a background of going out, partying, dancing, and music. It's our backbone, and it's very important because it's how we all met each other. Most of us met on the dance floor, so it's really essential to what we are about. And now, you are often described as a fashion label that is strongly influenced by the Berlin nightlife and techno scene, but now all the clubs are closed. I also read an interview that Benjamin Yu said, the biggest thing you're missing right now is to dance. How do you feel right now and where does your inspiration come from currently?
Well, it is actually still possible to dance in Berlin, so you know, any opportunity, I mean, you know, dancing always finds a way, whether it's in the forest with some friends or something like that.
I mean, so it started then afterwards. I think the interview was back in June or May.
When the lockdown had started.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Well, I guess, I mean, it was also like, I think for everyone, it was just like everyone was lacking some kind of, you know, physical intimacy with people. I mean, just in terms of like this sort of group dynamic, not even just dancing. And I think whether it's clubs or not, I think everyone's missing that, right?
I mean, I can tell. I really miss dancing with people and to merge with other people for music, actually.
Yeah. It's, you know, it's funny. I mean, I think both me and Serhat, I don't know if the original quote who it actually comes from. It sounds like a mix of something both of us have said over the years. But I think since we both kind of very much grew up in club culture, it's always been sort of very important to us, you know, music and dancing. And I think just the last few years, obviously it's just as you get older, but also you don't have so much time to go out, you know, it's becomes less important part of your weekly routine to go out.
But make it more special when you go then?
Yeah. And I think during the lockdown, it was noticed that even though it just meant, you know, going for an hour to a friend's set, you know, just having that opportunity to just having the freedom of being able to do it. Even if you were not going to go for long, just that little tea dance on a Sunday, whatever you want to do, you know, it's just, it felt like very far away suddenly.
And for you, Serhat?
Same, really. We pretty much both had the same desire to reconnect with that part of us again. Because, I mean, as Benjamin said, it's, you know, it's an important part of us and we grew up with it. And that's where all our friends are. And we have, you know, a lot of friends and music and DJs, and that's how we meet them as well somehow.
Yeah. Maybe the only chance sometimes.
Yeah, sometimes.
I also read that you both had the coronavirus, actually. Mm-hmm. And I also read that that was horrible. That yeah. it was not an easy flu, as some said. How are you doing today? I mean, you look pretty healthy. And
well, as far as we know, we're both recovered fully. I mean, I got a bit more sick than Serhat. Mm. It was, really bad for a few weeks.
Yeah. But how was that? Like, everybody's talking about this this virus, and you're sitting at home and you're suffering from that.
Well, I was lying in bed for over 2 weeks. I couldn't do anything, and I was off work for a month. So, it was horrible. And, you know, we still don't know how we got it, because we were both being like super careful and working from home. And
it was pretty at the beginning, wasn't it?
Yeah, it came exactly at the time where it was extremely crucial for anyone who has a business to, you know, save their business or, you know, go about decisions, you know, like... It was pretty hard.
That's exactly the point where I wanted to go to, because, I mean, you're both self-employed, and you have co-workers, mm-hmm. and you run a business. And as a self-employed, it's twice as bad, because, I mean, you said it, you were 1 month off work. And how does it feel?
Well, he was. I pushed through on Corona.
Yeah. How did you manage to keep the business running at that time?
Well, I don't know where the energy comes from, but I mean, for me personally, it was my recovery was not exponential. It was very like, it was a roller coaster, because I would rest a day and then I'd use the energy to, you know, keep salvaging the problems that had occurred due to Corona. So it was like up and down, up and down, up and down for me, my recovery. But I don't know, you push through. It's, you know, you built this, it's your baby, and you're going to make everything it's just like, you're going to make it work somehow.
I mean, at that time, all the stores got closed. Mm. That also means a huge financial loss, I assume. And how, like, did you already realize that at that time that you are facing a really, really strong time, and then also, of course, got sick because of the virus?
Well, I think for us, the most scary thing was like all the uncertainty, you know, not knowing, like, I guess, and I think that's the most terrifying thing for everyone. Like, what is this disease, this pandemic? What is this financial crisis? What does it all mean? I think a lot of it is much clearer to us now. And I think we're just, even though it's by no means over, I think it's sort of easier to deal with, because it's, I mean, we've had it. I assume we've been through the worst of the crisis in terms of for the company. Though, of course, that's not straightforward. I think we just, I don't know. What doesn't kill you make you stronger?
Sorry.
Sorry, I sometimes go a little bit cheesy with
But somehow it matches here. But yeah. The reason why I'm asking is, I mean, I have a lot of conversations with people from the nightlife industry who are facing a really strong or a really crazy crisis also. Also, we had a podcast episode about that, like kind of a reportage about the situation in Berlin and Germany. Mm-hmm. And like the fashion industry for myself is a little bit outside also, as it's somehow a consumption, like, you have a retail online and you can like continue, but of course if you're not set or if you don't have your distribution ways, you are facing a crisis as well, as you did. But I also read that you just started off with the or started more with the online retail.
Yes,
at that time.
Yeah
we had an online shop already that was more like in a, you know, a very small part of our business that we were just experimenting. So we had a setup, and then we just worked with our developers really closely to improve it so that we could have a lot more stuff on there, and just, you know, it just being a slicker operation.
It's interesting to see how you're facing or how you're managing the crisis, because, I mean, you're both creatives. You're not straightforward business developers or business managers. Maybe we can also circle back a little bit on your beginning of GmbH, or how would you pronounce it?
Well, we say GmbH.
GmbH, the German
others
term.
Others say GmbH.
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 In Paris.
The French one. Yeah, Benjamin, you're a photographer and you grew up in Norway and studied and lived in London for a time. And Sehat, you come from Herne, from the Ruhr area. We already had it. I'm coming from the same area.
Yes.
But you studied fashion in Bielefeld in Berlin. And you already had your own fashion label back in 2015.
I made a collection.
You made a collection.
I've always made collections. I wouldn't say it was a fully formed brand. I was doing collections.
So it just started with the creative part of a fashion brand. What could be a fashion brand?
Absolutely.
Can you tell me briefly how that came to you? Like, how did you start? What was the initial moment maybe in your life? As like, I know the Ruhr area is not pretty known for the fashion industry, maybe London a little bit more, but
yeah.
Like, how did you get there?
Well, I mean, if you want to, you know, look at it historically, then I mean, Düsseldorf is not the Ruhr area, but you know, like
pretty close.
Textile industry actually, yeah. Like comes actually from West Germany, Düsseldorf, and that's where all the fairs were back in the days. So there's actually a very, very large or used to be large industry there. But how I came about to study fashion, was that the question?
Yeah.
I don't know. It wasn't fashion per se for me. Like, I was never really, as a child or a teenager, obsessed with fashion. I was more obsessed with textiles and creating things with textiles. And then eventually I moved away when I was 16, 17 and went to art school. And I actually studied something else first before I studied design.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
What did you study?
I actually studied management.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, for a year, because I don't know, for some reason I thought that would come in handy at some point. So I studied that for 3 semesters or something. And then I switched to fashion because I had time to apply for the tests you have to go through to be accepted in art school. So yeah, I did that. And then the closest to what I was interested in was fashion. Yeah, that's really it.
And you two met in Berlin when you moved to Berlin, Sehat? And
we both were living here already for a long time before we met. Yeah. We only met like 5 years ago or something.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Pretty fresh. And where did you meet exactly? Like, can you remember the first time you've met?
Yes.
Yeah.
On a dance floor, maybe?
We met through friends at a party, and I don't know, everyone's asking us about everyone's asking about this story. Like, yeah, it was like some kind of legendary moment. But
yeah, but it's just not. Like, it was just really
banal.
Banal, yeah. You know, like there's no magical story to it. It was in a club. We were going out with friends and we have a lot of friends in common. And that's when it happened, basically.
And we just started talking and that's it. It was just like you meet any person, I think.
I mean, Benjamin, you were working at that time as a photographer already and also in fashion, and you've done a lot before. I mean, of course, you can see then there's a merge of interests when you're into fashion and you're obviously a fashion photographer. But how did you start the fashion brand then? What was your approach? Like, how did this start, the idea of maybe working together?
I mean, from my point of view, I mean, I was always kind of interested in fashion since I was a kid. I mean, at least, you know, my mom always used to make my clothes. So and my dad is kind of fashion obsessed. Like, so I had this like two very different angles to fashion. My dad had this obsession with kind of Italian luxury fashion, you know, being an immigrant from Pakistan, you know, he wanted to really dress up and really look good. And then my mom, who's more like, you know, a bit more alternative, was kind of, you know, more crafty and making all my clothes. So I grew up with these two very different kind of perspectives on clothes and fashion.
Also a little bit too extremes of fashion.
Very two very extreme. My parents weren't together, by the way. We didn't live in this. They didn't live in the same house, so it was two very different kind of angles. And I used to do fashion shoots with my friends when I was a teenager, or myself. I was kind of obsessed with photographing and staging shoots. And I mean, as soon as I had something, like whether it was Barbie dolls or stuffed bears, I would kind of make kind of photo shoots. So it was something I always did. I would make clothes out of paper, and I somehow ended up studying art instead, which was made more sense for me coming from Norway, because there isn't really like much of a fashion scene. And though I had a few friends around me that was also interested in fashion, it seemed like, at least if I was going to stay in Norway, that art made more sense. And then I, because of some personal events, I decided to leave Oslo, and I always wanted to move to London. So it seemed like a good opportunity to study there. And I studied art, and still got kind of sucked back into fashion now and then, and continue. I actually financed my studies by doing like shooting. So
it's pretty close. When you're studying art, you're also into like the visual concept of stuff, or like of fashion, or is it sculptures, etc. Then it's not that far away.
Yeah, I mean, even in my course, I mean, I remember like in my first year, I was actually making clothes that I was making things grow on. So it was like a very conceptual idea of like relating to the body. And so there was always an interest in this crossover between art and fashion. You know, my first thesis in art school was about a Margiela exhibition. So,
okay.
And another one was about like the fetish of Hitchcock, you know. So it was kind of, I was always kind of interested in these aspects. But moving forward, I mean, having worked both as an artist and photographer for many years, and I still had this like nagging urge to design clothes. And I obviously don't have the training. And after meeting Serhat, I just thought, oh, I had this idea of this little capsule collection. Do you want to help me developing it? Because that's something that Serhat was already doing with other artists and designers, and we compared our ideas, and it was just so similar that we just decided to work together on something instead.
You already said that, Serhat, you work at the time with different artists, and I've read that GmbH is a collective of 10 to 15 people.
Yes, that's bullshit. We never said that.
That's a rumor.
I think that's something that one journalist picked up somewhere at some point, because I guess at the time when we started, it was sort of like trendy to be a collective or something like that. But we were never a collective. It was always me and Benjamin who started it. And we have a very, very large community of friends that grew up here or spent most of their adult life here that we still collaborate with to this day. And even like from day one till today, like most of our models are our friends, or, you know, it's like vice versa. I mean, it's just, we just all support work together. Other, some, yeah. Exactly. We support each other, but there's no such thing as a collective.
Then one question that is also a little bit cheesy or sneaky, maybe. How did you manage to be successful in such a short time? Because, I mean, you've only been around since 2016 as a brand.
Well, I think that's for the outside perspective. Obviously, it seems like GmbH just kind of had a lot of hype and just happened very quickly. But both me and Serhat has been kind of working towards this our whole life.
Yeah.
So, you know, you have to imagine that I've already, you know, since I was 15, I was working, like I was publishing photographs in newspapers and magazines. So, and Serhat has been making clothes since, or, you know, garments since he was 5. And professionally, we both have done things. So we both had a lot of experience that combined meant that we could, you know, make something that, even though it was a very organic process, it just came very natural to us, you know? So it's really about two people coming together at the right time.
Maybe just a conclusion.
Yeah, yeah. But I think, yeah, and I think it's really important to take that into consideration, that we actually both been, you know, worked really hard on this and have a lot of, you know, training and skills to make this happen. You know,
I don't want to point it out to the hype that you're running a hype, because I mean, you're still one of the main fashion labels in your sector, also one of the brands that is represented in Paris for the Fashion Week, one of the German brands. I think there's no other at the moment. So I mean, there's no hype because you're still growing and growing and growing. And yeah, but it's interesting to see that it's like when you started a brand that it's in that short time. But of course, it makes sense if you're working on that for such a long time and just like releasing the brand at the very late stage of your careers, if you can say so, and then like got so popular in such a short time.
Well, I also think, sometimes these things has a lot to do with timing as well. And I think it was very like a good timing
for us. It was a good timing for us to talk about the things that we talked about. I mean, it resonated with people. I mean, I remember during my studies, our collections, we didn't get there. But like, I mean, if you know GmbH or a little bit like the context of what we do is like, it's a lot about like, you know, talking about our backgrounds, etc. And it just like resonated at the time with the audience. And I guess these things always play a role in, I guess, how you call it success, you know?
I mean, yeah, that's a question of definition, of course, success. Yeah. But what you said, that you're like also kind of telling your story. What I realized is that your collections are always picking up a topic, not just like color green in spring, for example, but like a very much a topic that reflects problems of the society that we are facing. Also, when I just looked up the name of your first collection, it was "I don't have any weapons."
Yes.
And I mean, that's a statement.
Yeah, you went back.
Yeah, of course.
You did your research.
Of course.
That's prior to GmbH, yeah.
I mean, that was the first collection? First official collection by Zahed
Ishi. Yeah, yeah, yeah. That was actually stolen from a showroom.
Oh.
Yeah.
But I mean, it has a really strong message that relate to the denunciation of Islam in the Western society.
Yeah. It was hard to defend this thesis at, it was during my master's thesis. It was hard to defend it even at school because people or my teachers didn't think that went together, you know? But I have always been interested in this topic. I mean, even prior to GmbH, my collections have always kind of were around identity politics or maybe about a personal healing process that I was going through as, you know, like a Turkish immigrant, you know, child or teenager.
And it's ongoing.
Ongoing. And I remember, I mean, it really changed over time because back then, like I remember people didn't even want to talk about it. Like, you know, it didn't make sense to put those topics together with fashion and, but that, I mean, as we are all observing right now, it's changing rapidly. At the time when we started doing it and talking about it, it was the right time for people to actually listen to it. And that's what I meant earlier, that the timing was right. Because, you have to be open for it. Because it's not easy to talk about. It's uncomfortable.
I mean, but that's what art must be about as well.
Absolutely, like, yeah.
Getting people uncomfortable and facing problems that they don't want to talk about. I mean, the fashion industry, I want to get to this point later as well. But I mean, what also you can see in your fashion shows that most of the models are people of color or immigrants that are not really represented in the fashion industry. And that's also facing a problem, pointed out a problem, and pretty progressive nowadays.
Well, I think when we started, the idea of like mixing politics and fashion seemed almost obscene to a lot of people. And I think now, especially this last year, this has become kind of more accepted that like the editorials of even big, you know, magazines like Vogue, you know, kind of take on this sort of representation and kind of civil rights movement as a sort of thing to champion, which is very, very new, because when we did it, everyone said, oh, you can't run a business and be political. That was like continuously what people were saying, literally. Telling us, you know, if you're being outspoken on politics, you're kind of like, you're basically losing clients. And that was not something we cared about. We just cared about being honest. And I think that's definitely become more the way now, you know, like, I mean, I think as our world seems to become more and more sort of polarized, people seem like they somehow have to take side, and which is not maybe always a good thing. I mean, for us, it was important because we were talking about ourselves, our personal experiences, and we want to defend ourselves and our communities. And so in many ways, we didn't really have a choice, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, in the end, it's your art piece. It's your...
Well, it's our story.
Exactly.
You know, it's... you know, a lot of times it's when you get questions around why you did that, and you know, it's the answer for us. I mean, I understand how and why people are asking, but the answer for us is very simple. It's like, yeah, it's just our story. You know, like when you speak about diversity and like all these things, it's not something we had to invent for ourselves to measure something in our company. You know, because in a lot of cases, it's something that exists because it has to be measured. And for us, it's not something that we measure. It's just merely who we are and what we just naturally represent, you know, ourselves. So it's, a lot of it is interesting to talk about at this stage because, yeah, kind of observing how it has changed in the past, like 5 to 10 years, say, from not being accepted at all to everyone wanting to talk about it and trying to understand it through our eyes a bit.
Maybe collaborate with you, because, I mean, you're standing for your story,
yeah,
and, like, your background, and other companies maybe want to merge or maybe want to grab a piece of it. Does that happen?
I don't know if it's like, I don't want to say it in a way that it sounds like the intentions were malicious. I'm not trying to say that, answering this question, but I think we always genuinely kind of felt if something was suitable or genuine in the first place. So if people approach us, then they approach us because they really want to collaborate with us, or they like what we do. But I'm sure maybe some people had those intentions. I can't say, but it's possible.
You're also collaborating with Honey Dijon, for example, not collaborating, but she's a big part of your campaign. Or
yeah, she was in our last film. We photographed her. She's walked our show. She's a dear friend.
Shout out to Annie.
Yeah,
she was my last guest here.
Oh, yeah.
She was right.
That must have been
there.
Fun.
Oh yeah, she called it a bad Tinder date.
Oh yeah, I can see.
Yeah, why does she fit so well to?
Well, I mean, if you ask like why does she fit, it's almost like you're asking us why did you choose her. I mean, it's like
we don't
choose people because they fit our brand. Like it's Honey is part of the family. You know,
I think it's really important that to realize that how we sort of choose our cast or how we photograph people or decide who's going to be in our show is not about fulfilling a role of, you know, any kind of preconceived idea of what kind of boxes we need to tick. For us, it's truly about authentically representing our community, and there's nothing else. You know, when we did our shows, we wanted them to be us. It wasn't like the show was meant to be so and so many people that was black and so and so many people that were from that origin. It was really just a natural process of like finding people that we felt represented.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I meant
community.
With like, we're not measuring this. You
exactly.
Know? There's no parameters to...
You can also see that in your latest film for the Paris Fashion Week, which is now online and you can watch it. It's called Guests on Earth. by Francesco Sandino.
Francisco.
Yeah. And Sandino, not Sandino.
Yeah.
But you can also see there that it's not the typical model that are just seen in the video, that there are also people, like, I had the feeling that there were people, maybe family or maybe people from the streets you know pretty well, or from, I don't know, the cafe next door.
Yeah.
And that was pretty, I don't want to use normal, but it was not that far away fashion brand that shows, I don't know, Gigi Hadid. And that's what I just, like, I really liked it about the video. You can really see that you're really paying attention on having family surrounded and not just book models and then giving instructions.
Yeah, I mean, the film was really about, I mean, we decided to make that film in a moment where we craved contact the most. You know, it was like right into the lockdown, I guess 3-4 weeks into lockdown, and we had just recovered from COVID, and it was really about kind of connecting with the people in our neighborhood and with reality somehow. And that wasn't that, and our first reaction wasn't immediately fashion. It was, what we needed wasn't clothes or beautiful. I mean, it's still beautiful images, obviously, but it was the human contact. I guess for both of us, it was very clear that we were going to go down that road because we needed it personally, I would say.
Yeah. I mean, for us, it was really important. We wanted to kind of create something that could be viewed obviously online, but that still had this visceral feeling of human contact, that you could feel you're in the same room with people. You feel like they're close to the camera or close to you. And even though it's, you know, highly stylized, the film in its kind of cinematography and sound design, it's something very real about it. And very, you know, as you said, the voices, you can hear them. And I think, I mean, we don't know everyone that was in the film. They were, you know, it was more just, sometimes we just met them by coincidence on the street, but it was really trying to capture this moment and people's thoughts in this very particular time. And, I think with GmbH, we always try to reflect or respond to what's going on in the world. I think that's really, you know, the main objective of GmbH is really to, we have this platform of fashion, yes, that can speak to a lot of people and you can reach a lot of people with it because it is a very immediate medium in a way.
Very direct.
It is very direct because it is superficial, because it is really about aesthetics, right? But it has this ability through the aesthetics to kind of sneak this other thing onto you, you know? So you can kind of, it's almost like a Trojan horse.
You can disguise a message in the beauty.
Exactly. Like, you know? I think the best example is a plain t-shirt with a sentence, like a slogan or something.
Mm.
I mean, you like the brand or you like the t-shirt itself, but of course you're also showing a message by wearing the t-shirt, which has a slogan on it. Maybe that's a good example as well.
Well, I feel like we're the total opposite of a slogan t-shirt, but so I don't like that example.
But I don't like the example either, but I hear what you're saying.
I mean, I totally respect Catherine Hamnett as a designer. She's kind of like made the whole, you know, political fashion slogan t-shirt. But I feel like the way we work is very different. Because since I also have background in art and doing exhibitions where you kind of, you know, you speak to a very specific kind of bourgeois kind of middle-aged, primarily white audience. I always felt like that never resonated so well for me because it was very frustrating because I felt like this is not really the audience I want to speak to. I don't really want to make work for just rich people. And I mean, I know what I said now can somewhat backfire and people said, but your clothes are so expensive. And that's another whole other topic, but
we can also get to that, but because I want to talk about production.
Yeah, okay, that's interesting. But my point rather was that with fashion, you just really have this. You can reach people in such a different way and so immediate, which I really like, and you feel the response immediately. Mm. You know,
talking about the stories. I mean, we've talking a lot about the stories you want to tell and about topics that are very recent and very current. I mean, you have a very interesting background as kids of immigrants, and Benjamin, your father, you already told us that he was pretty much into Italian fashion. But for example, today you just released a new sweater, which is like a combination of different cultures. I think it's
combined. If you want to talk about the origins of that specific jumper, so it's that we worked with an Iranian British artist who did the painting, but it's referencing an Arabic painting of the Zodiac from the Middle Ages. We like to work with a lot of, you know, we take our backgrounds and do a lot of research, historic research, and we find ornaments and details and traditional clothing, and then try to recontextualize them and make them very modern. I think they're, because we never really want to look historical somehow. It's never about kind of being
that's funny if you say that,
nostalgic.
Sad. I mean, you're coming from the rural area, and the first thing of when I see your clothes, it's like it's has a similarity with a worker clothing that I remember back from coal mining, for example.
Yeah,
like very strong structures. Yeah. And it's fun to see that like this time is still so much, or like this area is still so much in you, even that that you left when you were 16.
I mean, yeah, I mean, and for my entire childhood, I mean, my family came here as guest workers to mine, obviously. And I remember, I mean, my dad was literally like buried alive and retired from coal mining, you know. I mean, it's and I, you know, those were the garments we wore. Doesn't matter if our fathers who worked in the mines, or us as kids growing up. And I mean, it was that during the day. But then, you know, if we would go to a wedding of a cousin or like you know, someone related, then we look completely, like cakes. Yeah, you know, I mean, it's different. Just like, it's, you know, we would be like dressed in festive clothes, and I had these opposites always to my life, kind of. And that's what the clothes still are. I mean, you know, same for Ben. Like, I mean, you'd play with your mom's sari, and but also wear your dad's Italian, or were inspired by your dad's Italian obsession. I mean, it's all still inside GmbH, I would say.
Interesting to see that you both had like access to two very extreme sides of fashion, like the very easy, or like the strict worker clothing or Arbeitskleidung.
Yeah.
And then the festival of like the costumes and the clothing, and on the other side, like the Italian, the influence by your dad, the luxury Italian, and the easy, or like the very maybe, how do you say, what did you call it? Like the fashion of your mom.
More craft, alternative.
More crafty. Yeah, exactly.
Crafty and alternative. Yeah. I mean, I had that. I mean, like, you know, my mom was doing crochet, and my grandparents, and I don't know if you're like from that culture, it's like there's so much handcrafting involved in like, you know, everything somehow. And even this festive part is, I think we were once asked about elegance and what elegance meant for us, and why we're doing tailoring so much as opposed to, more, I guess, industrial clothes in our first collections. But it's, I think for both of us, it's really the remembrance of our fathers kind of dressing up to validate their existence. Not, you know what I mean? Mm. Just because, kind of thinking, just because we work in the mines doesn't mean that we can't look chic you know, at night,
yeah,
or going out, or in our daily lives. So there was a lot of like validation in dressing up, and that is elegant, or that is elegance for us somehow. Not the suit itself, but the reason why you put it on, to feel better about yourself, or yeah, to reflect some sort of beauty about you. Because obviously, like, you're in disadvantage already because you're a guest worker and you don't want to be judged for being filthy or dirty or not looking a certain way. So there was a lot of attention paid to getting festive and dressing up and tailoring. So that's really kind of the obsession we have with those different types of garments and clothing.
And then you came to Berlin, where you have a different, also maybe a different part of garments, a different, a whole bunch of different garments and textures in the nightlife scene, latex, vinyl, for example, that you're now adding to your clothes, like when you started GmbH.
Yeah, definitely. I think people make that connection much easier because of Berlin, that, and kind of explain themselves the leather and the vinyl. But honestly, that's how it snuck into our collections subconsciously. But honestly,
not on purpose.
I mean, we started working with deadstock material because we couldn't afford, you know, fabrics. We went to an Italian mill and started with fabrics that were available and that we could afford, and there was a vinyl and, you know, and still, like, I mean, we would you know, make deadstock vinyl things if it was available. That's sort of how it snuck in. But yeah, I mean, this whole fetish topic is obviously like quite important. But you know, fashion generally is like about fetish, really. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, it's pretty popular in the Berlin nightlife when you look at the outfits people wearing at Berghain, at KitKat. Then it's pretty fetish focused.
Yeah.
You like, you have this leftovers at the fabrics that you got, and that got you by coincidence maybe this this connection to the Berlin nightlife. How is it nowadays, as you're growing, or you were growing as a company? Are you still seeking out for residual materials, or?
Yes. Yeah, we still work. We work. I mean, as long as it's practical, we try to work with as much dead stock materials as possible.
Like, we did our recent collection with what we had in the studio, yeah, because all the mills were closed, especially because, you know, Italy was hit so hard with Corona. I mean, all the fabric mills were closed, and in theory, we made this recent collection again from all the deadstock material we had in the office, basically.
Yeah, how much effort does it cost you to like think about, or just limit to yourself to, for example, those materials you had in the studio?
We don't mind. We think we don't have really. We don't get upset because we're limited. I mean, it's the opposite, really. It makes us more focused.
I think it's when people ask us things like this, I think a good analogy is, you know, how kind of the whole sort of trend of local food became such a thing, you know, which was based on a very limited palette. You know, when you restrict yourself by just what's available or what's in season and so on, then you force new creativity. So
no strawberries in winter.
Exactly. So I think it's actually good to have limitations sometimes, that you can't do everything, you know. I think
I mean, I know you hate the word, but I think in the end it's sustainable, more sustainable.
Yes, it's responsible, I guess.
It is more sustainable.
Yeah, but
are you also trying to hold up a mirror for the fashion industry to that topic? Because I also read that you had a lot of conversation now during lockdowns with other brands about like how fast should the fashion industry be because I mean it's a very fast industry, and we have more collections a year, and you're kind of like, you're more outside of the box, as you said, like you're using reduced materials, and you're using the materials you got at the studio, and you're not like buying what's new, what's, I don't know, what's fashionable.
Yeah, I mean, I think, I don't know, for us, really everything we do is like, literally that's how we live our lives. Like there's nothing, I don't know, we don't think about a mirror or about parameter of diversity or anything. It's just, we just do as we live, and that's how we prefer to live somehow. It doesn't come from like, it's not driven by an intention or purpose like that. To what? Wanting to educate people like aggressively, yeah. But like obviously, like, you know, we represent, and if people are inspired by it, obviously there's education involved.
I mean for me personally, I mean, I was, you know, like a eco-activist very in my teens. So obviously I have a background in sort of eco-activism. So I would say like, in, of course it is somewhat important for me, but through all these conversations we have with other designers, we're obviously trying to move a bigger consensus towards having a sort of a broader understanding what responsibility, sustainability, what that really means, and how the industry as a whole can kind of move towards, you know, a better practices.
I mean, it's a broad term, sustainability.
It's very broad and it's so loose. And I think like, everyone wants to kind of be in on it. And I think for us, through this period of, it's just been very clear for us that the most sustainable, well, it was always clear to us actually, that the most sustainable thing is to not produce anything, right? So that's also why it makes sense to continue with working with materials that already exist. It also means that we have also decided to not make the company growth in a sort of capital growth as a sort of main target or as a sort of goal that we have to reach all the time. If it happens by itself organically, that's fine. But it kind of, that's probably the most sustainable way we can sort of work within our current financial system of capitalism.
So not scaling that much. Like having an investor,
not
like
obsessing about growth so much.
Yeah,
not just measuring taking your success on growth.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, changing that perspective a little bit.
Not planning your collection based on, okay, how can we sell more? You know, that's, we've taken that totally off the table. Actually,
I mean, that's pretty much matching like the vision of a lot of people in the club culture as well. Like being in the moment, don't like go through the whole capitalism school and make big money out of it. I mean, of course, there are always big players in every field, also in the fashion industry, obviously. But that's a nice bridge to the club culture and to the vision that the most of the people in the club culture
have. I mean, maybe it's informed by, definitely like by us, you know, living here. Like we've always, I mean, we choose to live here. It's not like Berlin has like a big fashion scene and that's why we're here, obviously, but...
I mean, London could have been maybe a better option in terms of business for fashion.
I don't know about that.
I don't know about that either. I mean, but I definitely know that it informs our thoughts.
I mean, we're here. We live in Berlin. Yeah. We've lived in Berlin so long, It just seems natural for us to be here. I mean,
I mean, it has advantages and disadvantages to be out of the circus cycle, whatever you want to call it, you know, but it's a personal choice definitely for us to be living here. And I guess that informs how you may think about growth or capitalism in some sort of way.
Yeah, you have less voices in your ear all the time and you have a sense, you know, you're measuring yourself less up against other people and you're in a way more neutral, but of course you're also more disconnected, so it's
and maybe more into other fields as well, as you already mentioned in the beginning, that a lot of friends of yours are DJing and like connecting then to them, and not only with fashion people, may have also this influence. But yeah, how important is nightlife to GmbH actually? I mean, we talked about it in the beginning.
I mean, it's part of our lives, our friends, and that's it's a space we still meet. You know, it's.
But hasn't nightlife and fashion always been kind of connected? Yeah. I mean, I think like if I think about any sort of important like fashion movement through any decade, there's always been like this, whether you're talking about Halston and Studio 54, and you know, you had Gaultier in the 80s, who was kind of, you know, both like Paris and London club culture. I mean, you had New York, you know, you had kind of fashion scenes connecting to that
club culture. So like
these things
Madonna
are always these things have always like connected, and I don't know, it's just
I mean, fashion, music, clubs just goes hand in hand.
Also back at the time that you mentioned, like Studio 54, for example, was a show off. I mean, everybody was suit up and showing themselves and show them. That's what Honey told me.
Yeah.
Actually, that everybody's showing their personality through fashion, and they planned 1 week ahead what they will wear.
Yeah, of course.
But as far as I realized that in the time now, I mean, nowadays it's more difficult to go to the club.
Well, I think but just to go back to the whole idea of this connection, fashion and club culture in Berlin, I would say this has always been quite different. Like in London, New York and Paris, it's always been very obvious, this connection. And, you know, there's so much like imagery of these clubs and people dressing up. And, you know, I was a club kid and I used to dress up, and you know, we spent like days getting our outfits together. And
yeah, we didn't do that here.
Exactly. But, and then in Berlin, it's totally different, you know, like in Berlin, it's not about being seen. It's not about being in the press. It's not about.
It's actually, those spaces are for people that exactly want the opposite, you know?
Exactly. So this is where it's kind of, this is like a kind of weird dichotomy, but that we are somehow connected to Berlin's club scene, and it seems like we can never sever that connection, even if we would like to. But still, there is, you know, you don't see pictures of people dressed in GmbH in a club in Berlin, because there are no
really pictures. maybe that's a point about it. Yeah, I mean, we are now getting to the end. I would rather talk with you a lot more, especially about the nightlife and the club wear. But just one final question. I mean, the question after the future of GmbH, and the future specifically about or the future of the fashion industry, as we are now having some sort of a change, I'd say. What do you expect from, or how do you see GmbH for the next years? Or maybe this year and the next one.
If you had asked me this last year and I'd given you an answer and I would be sitting here right now, I'd be laughing at it. So if one thing this year has taught us is that anything could happen anytime. Yeah. I wouldn't be surprised if there was a spaceship landing here right now. I mean, you know what I'm saying? Just like to exaggerate it a little bit. But I don't know.
I mean... what we want to focus on over the next years is really using this, what I call a platform of fashion that we've found. And, you know, this sort of influence that we've been given to continue helping where we can in terms of like social change, even if it's on a small scale, you know, it's whether it's about creating imagery of people of color or of other, you know, representing in a way that can give like some kids somewhere like the feeling that they might be also beautiful, or whether it goes into, you know, helping charity projects, or, you know, we have a lot of ideas in terms of like how to continue this process.
Yeah, I think Guests on Earth is maybe an example for that.
Yeah.
You know, like creating works that we've always been doing that. I mean, you know, it's like it's GmbH is not just about clothes per se. I mean, it's always about fashion, I guess, but it's, you know, so much more than that.
I would say it's, I mean, beyond fashion, it's also about kind of ideas and I think we want to just continue creating imagery and films and books and using fashion as this tool to move the world forward. And that's kind of
that's a good idea, ending, yeah. Actually. Sahad Benjamin, thank you so much for coming.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for being my guest.
Thank you.
That was my conversation with Benjamin Alexander Hüseby and Serhat Işık, the founders of GmbH. Really interesting to see their vision of GmbH as a company and how they stay progressive by being themselves and not adjusting to the regular fashion industry. Also interesting to see how they describe the connection between fashion and club culture. I hope you enjoyed the conversation too. Feel free to leave a review on Apple or text us on Instagram. Gesine and I always appreciate your feedback. I hope to see you very soon. We'll be in touch.
Das war der Telekom Electronic Beats Podcast.
Abonniert den Podcast bei Apple, SoundCloud, Spotify oder Deezer.
Wir sehen uns im Club.
Bis dann.